Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Sam, from the Solution on the Shore Group in Neptune, New Jersey.
Hi, my name is Sam. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 22nd, 2009. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I sponsor others. And my home group is Solution on the Shore in Neptune, New Jersey. It meets at 8 o'clock on Saturday nights. If you're ever in the area, you should definitely stop by. We have a really good time. I'm here to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was born into a very loving family. I lived on the Jersey Shore in a very small town. There were about 30 kids in my entire class from my entire elementary school time, from kindergarten to eighth grade. And there was no doubt that my family loved me. My grandmother, when I was about five, wound up getting drunk one night, and she wound up going after my grandfather. I wound up getting in the way of that, and she dropped a knife into my foot. After that, she was sent to rehab. Within the same month of that, my mom was diagnosed with cancer, and she went to the hospital. And I took that all as these people didn't love me, they didn't care about me, and something was wrong with me. I was sent to live with different families of friends that lived in town, and they all welcomed me with open arms and wanted me to feel like anybody's brother and sister. They just, you know, wanted to let me know that they were there for me. And I constantly just felt like I wasn't good enough, like I wasn't a part of anything, like all these people were judging me, and it made me feel totally separate from everybody. I guess my grandmother went to rehab. She got out, and for the next year, she wasn't really allowed to take care of me. And that's about the same amount of time that my mom was getting treated. Not that long after that, we were supposed to go on a family vacation to Disney World. And the night, or two nights before that happened, my grandmother fell and broke her leg. So my mom and I wound up going alone together. And when we got back, I remember going inside, bringing her suitcase upstairs for her, and all over her bed was an entire recycling bin of empty alcohol bottles that my grandfather had dumped over her bed, with a note that said, "We need to talk." And at the time, I didn't really understand what was going on. I understood that, you know, when she, there were some nights when she acted differently and some nights that she would just fall asleep sitting in a chair and there was nothing I could do to wake her up, but I didn't really understand what was causing that. So I felt some relief thinking, okay, well, maybe this will stop happening, you know, maybe things will change. My mom, when she saw it, did not feel the same way. She totally freaked out, and it got pretty ugly. But that day was a turning point, because from that point on, my mom started going to meetings, and she didn't remain sober. She's been in and out ever since. But my grandmother has stayed sober this whole time. And from a very young age, I was exposed to alcohol. My first sponsor said alcohol will become more a part of your story than you ever realized. And it's true, because all these things, these experiences that I had when I was little, I didn't even realize all the connections that it had. I'll get to that later on. So for the next few years, you know, I was with the same 30 kids, and it was the same people every year. There was no change. And as the years went on, I just felt more and more separate from them. My mom was going to school to get her PhD, and her relationship with my grandparents was very variable, depending on if she was sober at that time or not. So there were some months when my grandparents would be allowed to take care of me, and there were some months when she wouldn't allow it. And the months when she wouldn't allow it, I went back to staying with friends. And those months made me feel horrible about myself, because I didn't understand why. I didn't understand why, you know, my grandparents weren't a part of my life at those times. There was one month when I just couldn't take it anymore, and I was staying at my friend's house. It was like three houses down from where my mom lived, and at the last minute, I was told that I was going to be spending the night there, and I was supposed to be going home to my grandparents' house, and I wasn't allowed to. So I waited for everybody to go to sleep, their parents, everything. And I snuck out of their house, and I wrote them a note that said I went home. And I did go home. And my mom wasn't home. And I sat there, and I waited by the door for her to get home. And she showed up. She didn't drive herself. She had a car service drop her off. And she was totally drunk and didn't know what to do. And I actually wound up going back to my friend's house and spent the rest of the night there because I didn't know what to do either. All these things I was trying to control, and there was nothing I could do about any of them. By the time I was in 7th or 8th grade, my grandparents could see that something was not right, that I was totally unhappy, that I really wasn't functioning anymore. My mom basically thought that if everything was okay on the outside, everything was okay. And, you know, in order for her to make things seem okay on the outside, there were days when she was doing my homework for me. She would pay me money to do well in swim meets. And I'm not saying anything like my mom didn't love me. She absolutely loved me. She always wanted the best for me. This is the only way she knew how to do it. So by the time 8th grade came around, my grandparents said it would be best if I went away to a boarding school. And I was totally full of fear and didn't want to go, but I also was totally miserable, and I was finally willing and ready to admit that to myself. So I thought, okay, we'll give it a shot. I wound up applying to a bunch of different schools. My mom wound up writing the essays because it would look better if she did it. Fortunately, I tested pretty well, so my test scores were good enough. And I wound up getting into all the schools that I applied to. I didn't do any of the work to really get into them, but I got into all of them. And it got to the point where I could decide. I could go to any of them. My grandparents really just wanted me to be happy. My mom just wanted me to be happy. Everybody just wanted me to be happy. And they thought it was amazing that I had all these choices, and it was. And I was very fortunate to be given that opportunity. I wound up deciding on going to an all-girls boarding school just outside of Boston, primarily because my mom's sister and her husband and two kids lived probably 10 miles away from that school. And I was my parents' only child. My dad wasn't really a part of my life at that point. And my cousins, her kids, were pretty much like my brother and sister. They were the closest thing I had to that. So I wound up going there, and of course I brought myself with me. So I got there, and I still didn't feel a part of. I felt like everybody could make friends better. Everybody knew somebody. Everybody was doing better or looked better or was better in some way than I was. And I felt like there was no way I could fit in. So I did, you know, what I thought was right. I did what everybody else wanted me to do, or what I thought everybody else wanted me to do. By the end of my fourth year there, I was all-school co-president. I was a three-season varsity athlete. I was in the National Honor Society, and I did all these things, and I was totally miserable. During my time there, my aunt and uncle were a very big part of my life. They basically became my parents. Their children became my brother and sister, and they made me feel like I was a part of something, like I was a part of their family unit. They never made me feel different. They redesigned their whole attic. They let me design it so it could be my room when I went there on the weekends. They let me help design the ski house that they bought. They absolutely wanted to be a part of my life and wanted to be there for me and wanted me to be a part of their lives. And I think my sophomore year, they noticed that something wasn't right. They noticed that I wasn't eating. They noticed that I wasn't happy and that I was doing all these things and I still wasn't happy. And that I had been removed from the situation that they had thought was the problem, and it wasn't. So they started sending me to therapists. I would go to therapists twice a week at the beginning. And then afterwards they would pick me up. I'd go have dinner at their house, and then they'd bring me back. And they did that for the next 3 years of my time in high school. They were always there for me. Drinking wasn't allowed at my high school. Smoking wasn't allowed. These were all things that were socially unacceptable. So it just wasn't something that people did. It wasn't something people talked about. The first time I drank was the summer between my junior and senior year in high school. And I went to Spain to do a homestay, and I went there with 13 different kids from around the United States. And we all got on a plane in New York and flew into Madrid, and as soon as we got off the plane, we were all legally able to drink because we were 16. And that's exactly what we did. We all went out, and we all got drunk. And for the first time ever, I didn't care what these strangers thought about me. I didn't feel different than anybody. I didn't feel like I needed to impress anybody. I didn't feel like I needed to be whoever they wanted me to be. I felt okay with who I was. And, you know, I constantly was seeking that feeling for years after that. I didn't really drink again while I was in Spain because we went to different parts. And I got back to school that fall, and for the rest of the year, it was just another year at school for me. But that year, I really stopped eating entirely because I felt like it was the one thing I had control over. I couldn't control anything else, but that was something I could control. At the end of that year, I went to work as a lifeguard and camp counselor at a summer camp here in New Jersey. And it was a religious summer camp that my mom and aunt and uncle had all worked at when they were growing up. My family was big on church. When I was growing up, it was the one time that my mom and my grandparents and I would get together every week. And I didn't really understand what was going on at church. I just understood that that was the one time that my whole family would come together. I didn't really pay attention. I didn't understand the God thing. And it wasn't really forced on me in any way. It was just the one time that we all came together. So from there, I worked at that summer camp, and I met a guy. And that guy got me out of my head and got me thinking about something other than myself and thinking about how I felt different than everybody. And he wound up going to college in Boston, so when I was going back to high school, he was going to college there too. And for the next year, we had an awesome relationship. Every time I would go to my therapist, he was in the same area, so I would see him those days, and then I'd go have dinner with my family. I saw him on the weekends. He would come to any activities I had. I would go to anything he was doing. And we had a good year. And prom came around, and that morning I went to his dorm room to get ready. And I got there, and he wasn't there, and I asked his roommate where he was, and his roommate hadn't seen him for a few hours. And I guess a couple hours after I'd been sitting there, we got a call from his parents saying that we needed to get to the hospital because he had been out. And he had been going for a run and saw some lady getting mugged and wound up trying to help her and not surviving. So from that point on, I can't really tell you what the end of my senior year was like. I wish I could. I know that I spoke at graduation. I have no idea what I said. I know that there was one night when my friends and I felt like we had completed high school enough that we could drink without any repercussions, and we did drink. My friend and I wound up getting sexually assaulted, and we agreed that we weren't going to tell anybody what had happened that night because we didn't want to get in trouble at school, and I was okay with that, but when we got back to school, she wasn't. And she wound up telling them, and they wound up reporting it to our colleges, and nothing came of it, but that was just an example like of how bad I felt about myself. I just didn't feel like I deserved to tell anybody what was going on. I was also caught smoking cigarettes behind a dumpster by my advisor, which apparently she thought was a big deal, and I totally didn't. But I was supposed to be this role model, and here I am standing behind a dumpster smoking a cigarette, and She took it as a sign that something was going on because it was something I had control over. And it was a sign that something was going on, but it wasn't something that I was willing to talk to her about or something I felt anybody would ever understand. So from there, I went back to work at that summer camp again. And it wasn't the same. It was the same people that I had been friends with the summer before, the same people that I had kept in touch with all year. But it just didn't feel the same to me. So about halfway through the summer, everybody else was at dinner, and I locked myself in one of the lodge bathrooms, and I drank half a gallon of bleach and woke up 5 days later in an ICU. And I was just so uncomfortable with myself. I didn't have a solution. I didn't have any way of dealing with anything that was going on with my life. And I remember waking up and just being so mad that I was alive, so mad that I had survived that. And they wound up sending me to a psychiatric hospital from there. And I was in that psychiatric hospital for about 3 days. The first opportunity that my mom and stepfather had to come and visit me, they did. They came and they signed me out the same day that they came because they said that I wasn't crazy, that I didn't belong there, and that there was nothing that those people could do for me because I'd been in counseling for years already, and if that didn't make me better, then nothing would. So they signed me out, and they took me home. And I guess that they thought that inpatient counseling wasn't right for me. But we did try outpatient counseling, and I feel like I went to probably 60 different doctors for the rest of that summer. Every day it was somebody different, and somebody giving me a different diagnosis and a different prescription. And none of it worked. By the end of that summer, I was even more miserable than I was at the beginning, it felt like. It was decided that I wouldn't go to the college that I had decided I was going to go to before I left high school. They thought that I should stay in New Jersey and be closer to home and closer to my family. And I did. I wound up going to Rutgers. And for the first semester, I was on the crew team. I didn't get out of bed, but I would get out of bed to go to practice, and then I would go right back to bed when everybody else was going to class or going to eat or going to do something. I went back to bed. And I did that for an entire semester, and at the end of the semester, my mom asked me why I had failed. I told her it was because my roommate had been drinking in our room every night, which was absolutely true, but it had no bearing on why I had failed. So my mom, of course, wanting the best for me, called the dean, and my roommate wound up getting kicked out of our dorm entirely. So then that gave me an open space in my room, and there were a lot of people that lived on my floor, but there was this one guy who absolutely hated his roommate, who thought that I was cute and told me he loved me, and I told him he could move into my room. And that filled that little hole for a little bit of time, too. That kept me occupied for about a semester until, you know, he wasn't good enough anymore. He didn't make me feel okay enough. I wasn't okay anymore. We wound up getting a place together off campus, and that summer I really don't remember much of. I would do anything and everything to not feel like myself, because that had been the only thing that I had seen my entire life that I had some control over, was using external things to not feel like myself. So I basically came to at the end of that summer in September when I found out that I was pregnant. And for the 9 months after that, I managed to stay sober. I quit smoking. I did all these things. Our son was born, and he was healthy, and I wound up getting rushed away pretty much immediately because I wasn't okay. They did a bunch of tests on me and found out that I had cancer, and for the next 6 months after that, I was in the hospital pretty much the whole time getting treated for that, and they did get into remission, but by the time I got out, I was extremely hooked on painkillers. And, you know, I don't think they really did that much for my pain, and I really wasn't in that much pain towards the end, but I was just so hooked on the feeling of not feeling like myself and using that to just not feel like myself. And the whole time, I had been very leery of drinking because I had seen what it had done to my mom. And, ever since I was little, I told myself I never wanted to be like that. I never wanted to have a child brought up like that. I never wanted all these things. So I just stayed away from alcohol, but substituting it with something else. And it had the same effect. So the painkillers led to other substances, and that led to 4 years that I did a lot of destruction in. At one point, I wound up waking up in the ICU again. I had been unconscious for 14 days, and my grandparents had been there every day. And I had to learn how to walk again because my muscles had atrophied so much. And as soon as I got out, I went right back to doing what I was doing. I spent a lot of time just trying to make all these external things okay still so that you wouldn't realize how unhappy I was and everything that was going on with me. I always wanted what was best for my son, and I just wasn't able to provide for him the type of life that I felt he deserved. So those 4 years went by. I had a job. I was able to show up for that, but mostly because it supplied the money that I needed to do all the other things that I needed to do. I wound up getting arrested on December 21st of 2009. And that was not a choice that I ever could have made for myself, because I would keep drawing the line in the sand saying, well, I'm not that bad because I haven't done this yet, or I'm not that bad because I'm not at this point yet. And I would do that and constantly keep changing my standards and keep changing what was acceptable, and none of it was acceptable. And I would tell myself I was going to stop, and I would say things are going to be different, and it was never possible. So at the end, I was totally even afraid to answer my phone, because I had called all these people and manipulated them and tried to use them in whatever way that I could that I needed to get what I needed to get. And I couldn't keep the story straight anymore. And I had people calling me just out of concern, and I was too afraid to answer the phone. So I wound up getting arrested. And when I got arrested, I had 14 outstanding warrants for different traffic violations that I would keep getting bailed out by my grandparents and then never show up at court, because I would get bailed out and say, I fully intend on going, and it just would never happen. I was so full of fear when the court day would come and what the repercussions would be and all of that, that I would just, by the time the day would show up, I would have worked myself up into such a fear-driven situation that I wouldn't make it. I just wouldn't show up. And they would keep bailing me out. But that day I knew that it wasn't going to happen, and it wasn't a minor traffic violation. I had gotten out of other situations by actually becoming a criminal informant for the state police. I wound up getting shot at. I wound up in car chases. I had all these unacceptable situations that I would just justify in some way because it would help me in some way. I would benefit. So I got arrested, and I had nobody to call. It was the first time I realized that there was nobody that was going to come and get me that time. I wound up getting arrested right around Christmas, and I remember that I was too full of guilt, shame, and remorse to call my grandparents for Christmas. I wouldn't call anybody because I knew that there, you know, I wasn't expecting anybody to bail me out. And I really didn't want to hear them crying on the other end of the phone again. And I really didn't want to put them in that situation where they wanted to help me and they just couldn't anymore. But after I'd been there for about 10 days, I decided that I would call them, actually because I had been transferred to the hospital because I was so dehydrated. And I actually went in there with a full case of pneumonia that I wasn't doing anything about. And they had to put me on a breathing machine for a significant amount of time every day, so they had to transfer me to the hospital, and I decided that I would try and call my grandparents. So I called, and I called, and I called, and I called for days, and I was convinced that it was something that I had done, that they didn't want to talk to me. But something kept telling me to just keep calling, so I did finally. And my aunt answered the phone, and she said that as soon as your grandfather heard that you were arrested, he wound up having a heart attack and is in the hospital. So he wound up being okay, but it was a big awakening for me to realize how much, you know, I had been taking from these people, not just financially, but emotionally, and keeping them up every night and taking their peace of mind all the time. So I was in the first county for about 74 days because with 14 warrants, you wind up going to a lot of different counties. I spent 74 days in the first county, and I would love to tell you that there was nobody in there carrying this message and that there weren't meetings available, and there were meetings available. There were meetings available a few times a month. And there was actually this one woman who was a prisoner there who was carrying this message, and I was totally unreceptive. I was put into a cell with this woman. I wound up getting switched around a lot because, you know, I'd never really done time in jail before. So people would steal things from me or want me to be in a relationship with them, and it was just awkward. So... So they moved me around a lot. I got very good at moving, you know, my little sheets and stuff around the jail. That was a pretty good skill to have if you were in my situation. One of my cellmates did have a big book, the one with the large print, and she was like, well, you know, you go to all these meetings, and I was going to the meetings just so I didn't have to be in that little room with the same people all the time. We would just go to a different little room. And I would go, and I wouldn't pay attention, and I would just go for the little walk down the hallway because that was the excitement. And she was like, well, you go, so you're going to need this more than I will, because she had no interest. So she gave me her big book, which I guess she thought gave her permission to steal my sweatpants. So it was a trade, I guess. So that whole experience happened, and I wound up getting switched after she stole my sweatpants because I didn't really even care. I mean, I didn't want to cause any more drama. I didn't want to be moved again. But other people cared that she had new sweatpants, and I just had a big book, so. So I got moved again. And I went from that cell to a different cell. But the woman that was in there carrying the message always tried to talk to me. And I would listen to what she had to say, and I would tell myself that it wouldn't work for me. She talked to me about how she would go out and speak to all these people and all these meetings and young people and old people, and she could identify with all these people and that she had felt the way I had felt. And I was like, well, of course you felt the way I felt. You're sitting in jail right now. You've got nobody else. So that obviously was not the case. I know that now, but she really was trying to get through to me, and I just was totally unreceptive. So after those 74 days in that county, I got transferred to a different county, and I found out I was going to court in that county, and I was totally terrified because this was one of the cases I had been a criminal informant on, which was supposed to get dismissed but then didn't because I had so many other warrants that it just got to be a big mess. So I go to court there, and for the first time in a long time, I prayed, and I just prayed that God would not give me more than I could handle. And the judge wound up giving me 90 days, which seemed like forever at the time, but really when I was facing like 3 years for it, 90 days was really nothing. So I get transferred from those sheriffs to the other county sheriffs. And the first thing that the guards say to me when they bring me to the jail is, welcome to hell. I get put into... I guess medical confinement, because even though I was medically cleared in one jail, they didn't transfer the paperwork. And I wound up spending 10 days waiting for paperwork to come from the other jail. In that time, they could have medically cleared me many times over. And I would have all these different people come into my cell and leave the next day and come in and leave and come in and leave because they were all getting put into permanent cells, and I was just still in this cell, primarily alone. We weren't allowed out. We were allowed out at 5 a.m. for 10 minutes to shower when we were in medical confinement. So finally, after like 10 days, one of the guards is like, how long have you been in here? And it was a long time. So he wound up getting me medically cleared within like 2 hours. And he put me in this cell. And as I'm walking up the stairs to this cell, one of the other inmates is like, oh, you're going in there? Well, good luck with that one. And I have no idea what she means, but I'm totally full of fear because, you know, I don't know what I'm about to walk into. So I walk into this room, and it's this woman from Ghana who's been in that jail for 18 months. She's there for trafficking children. She doesn't like white people. She doesn't want to talk to me. She wants absolutely nothing to do with me. And she tells me to take a washcloth and go over to the window and write to the men that are in protective custody through the window with a washcloth. And I don't want to cause any problems with this woman. I'm terrified of her. And I basically spend 2 weeks of that time just staying on the top bunk, just trying to not interrupt her, because she's been there for 18 months. She's got this figured out. She's got a whole way of cooking in the little sink, and she's got it down. So I don't want to interrupt that. And she barely speaks English. The few things she knows are like no and hi. And I heard no a lot. So after a few weeks of being there, the one thing I do notice is that she prays all the time. That's what she does. She constantly prays. She wakes up in the middle of the night to pray. She prays at shift change. She prays all the time. And so I started to think, well, she's gotten through 18 months here. And while in those few weeks that I'd been there, somebody in our pod sprayed the nurse in the face with 409. So we weren't allowed out again, really, after that. Every other day for 10 minutes to shower or to call somebody. So we had a lot of time to be in this little cell together. And I started to pray. And she would notice that I started to pray. And as time went on, she asked me to start reading things from the Bible to her, which I did. And I started teaching her English. I started teaching her the alphabet, teaching her numbers, things like that. And none of the other guards really understood. I guess I was one of the good inmates, so they would talk to me sometimes and let me out for extra time to do things to help, like clean or whatever. And they would always not understand how I could live with this woman because she seemed so mean and so cold. And really, that woman gave me a purpose. She made me feel like for once in my life, well, for once in the recent past that I could remember, I was doing something helpful to somebody other than myself, and I wasn't hurting anybody anymore. And by the time I left, she told me I was the best cellmate she'd ever had, but really she had done so much more for me. I wound up going back from there to that first county, and it was a totally different group of people. I was there for I think 10 days waiting for that court date, and then I wound up getting transferred to the third and last county. I was there for a couple days. I got seen by the judge, and the judge told me that since it was video court, she needed me to be there in person, and that I would have to spend another week there. And I told her that I had been in jail already for about 6 months, and that I really wanted to get out to get myself help and to get treatment, which was true. That was really what I wanted to do. And she wound up letting me go that day. She just dismissed the case and let me go. But that great relief of finally knowing that I was getting released was matched with the fact that I had nowhere to go. I had burned all those bridges. I called my grandparents, my grandmother, who had gotten sober 18 years before that, the same one that had dropped the knife into my foot, had been an active member of AA for 18 years. And when I called her that day, she said, well, your grandfather and I can come and pick you up, and we'll take you wherever you want to go. And I thought, well, that's not going to do me that much good. I have nowhere to go. Like, I could be homeless here, or I could be homeless wherever. But they showed up. They came to get me that day. And when I got into the car, my grandmother said, if you really want to make a change, if you're really serious about this, you can stay with us, but the first time you mess up, you're out. And I really had no better options. At that point, I was broken. I was ready to surrender. I was totally willing to change things. And that's what I did. The first night, she dropped me off at this meeting that I guess she used to go to years before that. And I walked in, and it was apparently not an AA meeting when I got there. These people looked at me like I was crazy when I asked where the AA meeting was. I don't know. I don't know what they were doing, but it wasn't AA. And after that, the next day she dropped me off at this clubhouse that we have in Belmar. And she told me that they had meetings there all day and to sit there and to go to as many meetings as they had that day and not to go home until the last one was over. And that's what I did. And I did that for weeks. And I was so miserable. I was sitting there and hearing these people say, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I'm sitting there thinking, I've gone to 90 meetings this week. Like, what are you trying to tell me here? Like, so I definitely did the 90 meetings in 90 days, but that really, it wasn't helping. And they would say, you know, first things first and easy does it and things like that. And I really had no idea what anybody was talking about. I would just sit there and they would read how it works, and I would just think, wow, that's a really long thing to read. Like, that was just what was going through my mind. And all these people were laughing and happy, and I was sitting there totally miserable, doing what it sounded like they were telling me to do, and I didn't get it. I didn't understand what sitting in that room with these people was accomplishing. I sat there for weeks, and I was thinking, my ego was telling me, okay, well, you're doing what they're saying they're doing, so you should be fine, you know, just keep going. Maybe it'll get easier. Maybe you have to give it the 90 days, not just the 90 meetings. These were all things that I was trying to figure out what people were talking about. It wasn't working. I would leave these meetings, and I would sit on the bench outside, and I would cry because I just didn't understand. I didn't know what was going on. And I really didn't want anything to do with any of you, to be honest. So finally this man had seen me coming every day and seen me at all these meetings and was like, you know, we don't have to do this alone. And I didn't really understand what he meant, because people had talked about sponsors and they talked about, you know, the fellowship. And all I saw at these discussion meetings were people sitting there talking about their problems and not how they were getting better. I didn't understand the connection. I didn't understand what was going on. And he told me the name and place of this meeting that a lot of younger people went to, and he gave me the name of somebody to look for when I got there. And I went to that meeting, and I stood in the back, and I didn't talk to anybody, and I left feeling even worse than I did when I got there, because I saw all these young people that had exactly what I wanted. They were happy. They looked like they were having fun. They had friends. You know, I had nobody left at that point. There was nobody I could call other than my grandparents. So I left that meeting, and I went home. And the next day, I went back to the clubhouse and sat through all those meetings again. And at the end of those meetings, there was a different man that came up to me, and he was like, you know, you were supposed to call this person. I was like, well, I never got her number. I didn't talk to her. And he was like, well, I'll give you her number. So he did, and I did not want to call her. I really didn't. And it took a few days for me to get up the courage to pick up the phone. And I finally did. And she made it really easy for me. She was like, I heard you're looking for a sponsor. I'll do it. And I was just like, okay. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what she was going to be doing with me, but okay. She was like, that night she was planning on going to New York City to hear somebody speak. And she invited me to go. And I was like, I don't know. You know, my grandparents are giving me $20 a quarter for the week, so I don't know how I'm going to get to New York City with that. And she offered to pick me up, but then I still had to tell my grandparents that this is what I was doing, and they weren't impressed. But they did let me go. So I think my grandmother was just happy to hear me use the word sponsor, and I had one in the same sentence. That was really good for her. So I went, and the sponsor was in a meeting, and her home group was one that she had worked on developing. It's my home group now. But she wasn't brought through the steps directly out of the big book. She was brought through them with the 12 and 12 and using the big book. And she started taking me through it the same way she had been through it. And there was no doubt in my mind that she had a spiritual awakening as a result of doing it that way. I didn't get all the way through them with her because she wound up leaving the country. She went to Guatemala. And from the beginning, she, you know, made it clear that that's what was going on. But I was just so happy to have a friend, really. I didn't really care if she was leaving. And that was really the first time that my people-pleasing and wanting to feel a part of became an issue in sobriety, because the people that we were around, all the people that she was friends with, our home group, was going through the steps directly out of the big book. And somebody would say something like, what step are you on? And I would say, I'm still on one, or I'm still on two. And she was taking it through me the way she had been brought through it. She was passing on her experience. And I went to her with that. I told her that I was feeling insecure. I told her that I was around all these new people that are, you know, telling me that I should be doing something different. And she said, well, I won't be offended if you go and do what they're doing. I can only pass on what's been passed on to me. And I realized at that point that I couldn't please everybody in that situation. And I felt a connection with this woman. And at that point, that was more important to me than trying to please everybody else. So she wound up getting me through a lot this summer, or that summer. And I can honestly say, looking back on it, that it was one of the best summers I've ever had. I've been arrested in sobriety. That summer, I went to court for the first time since I was out of jail, because some of the courts gave me different court dates for after I got released. And I think the first three times I went to any different court, I wound up getting arrested for something. I don't even know how that was possible in all those situations, but it was, apparently. My grandmother would come, and then she would cry because one time she had taken the court notice because I still wasn't responsible enough for that, and I definitely wasn't. So she kept track of the date, but she had the date wrong, so we showed up the day after, and I wound up having a warrant out. So it just happened a lot. It seemed like every time I called this woman, she was like, I had something to tell her, because I went from getting arrested every time I went to court to having one of my best friends OD and pass away, and I was able to give her eulogy. Not very long after that, I went on a camping trip, and I actually wound up getting pregnant on that camping trip, and that brought on a whole new set of life situations that I probably wasn't ready for, but definitely had to deal with. We decided we were going to keep the baby, this man who was not really anything to me. He was somebody that I knew, somebody that was, you know, in my home group, somebody that was around a lot, but he wasn't my boyfriend. He wasn't really, you know, a significant part of my life at that point. And I wound up moving out of my grandparents' house into an Oxford house. Oxford House wound up not being a good living environment for me, and I wound up having to ask that person if I could move in with him for a few weeks until I could move to Boston, where I was actually offered an amazing job with my high school. My high school was aware of what had been going on with me because I had kept in touch with some of the people, some of my teachers there, and they offered me a job as their peer educator. You know, to talk to students that were currently there about what had gone on in my life. And that seemed like a really awesome opportunity, and I was prepared to take it. But I guess probably a week or two before I was supposed to go, I went back to the doctor and found out that the cancer that they had put into remission had come back. And that complicated things a lot. I wasn't able to go to Boston. I needed to be around the doctors. We had decided to keep the baby, which meant that I couldn't really do treatment, which seemed to be okay at the time. My oncologist told me that, you know, things should be fine until the baby was born. And that hasn't exactly been true. The cancer has progressed significantly since then, but there's nothing they can do until the baby is born. And that's just the way things are. My relationship with my son's father ended the day we got arrested together. My son was staying with my ex's parents when we were in jail. And then when my ex got bailed out, he went back to stay with his parents. And one day during the summer, my ex was watching him and wound up getting high and ODing. And the police were called, and my son got put into foster care with the state. My ex has been in and out of jail since then. I've had to get 3 new phone numbers. He used to show up at my apartment. Not a very good situation, and he wound up showing up around where my son was put into foster care. And the caseworker called me. I'd been going to see him twice a month ever since he was put into foster care. And the caseworker called me and said that she thought it would be best if I didn't see him until they could find a new place for him, because she didn't want there to be a scene between me and my ex in front of our son. And I totally agreed with her on that. And not long after that, she called me back and she said, you know, we can still find a place for your son, but the foster family he's with now would really like to adopt him. And I went back and forth on that for a while because I love him and I really want what's best for him. But I had to decide that what was best for him was for him to stay with the family he's with now. And I had to give up my parental rights to him. I'm not allowed to see him. So my life in sobriety has definitely not been easy. But I've gotten so many gifts out of this program. I've been through the steps. I got to make amends with some people that I thought I would never get to see again, people that I thought would never want to talk to me again. One night after our home group, about 10 of our home group members piled into a car and drove up to Boston just so that I could go make amends there. And I think I did like 10 amends in one day, and we didn't sleep at all. We had an awesome time. And these people just followed me around and met complete strangers, and my friends were like, who are these people? And I was like, I'll get to that. But it was an amazing experience. I definitely have a lot of people in my life today that actually want me to be a part of their lives and make me feel like I am a part and make me feel like I belong someplace. You know, getting to sit with a new person and sit and share my experience, strength, and hope with that person, and then watching that person, having the privilege of taking that person through the work and watching them change has been one of the best things, you know, one of the best experiences of my life. Basically, I don't think I would be able to handle the things that I've handled in sobriety if I was out there. I probably would have killed myself. I can't say for sure because that's not what's happened, but I'm pretty sure that as a result of this program, I'm able to stand here today and I'm able to be okay with myself and the decisions I've made and what's gotten me here and tell you honestly what's happened. Even when I first started meeting these people, I remember I was brought to a barbecue on the 4th of July and my sponsor was supposed to be there. And she met me there, but somebody else wound up bringing me. And we met these people at BJ's to pick up some supplies to bring. And I was introduced, and this man thought my name was Pam. And I was so broken that I couldn't, you know, I didn't correct him. I was just like, uh-huh, yeah. So I was introduced to a whole bunch of people as Pam. And it took until my year celebration for people to make that clarification. So, you know, I'm okay with who I am, and I'm okay with the things that I've done. And my aunt and uncle, the ones that live up in Boston, I went to make amends with them, and I was told that they weren't ready, and that's okay. I go to church every Sunday with my grandparents now, but I actually get something out of it. On Easter, my aunt and uncle are coming down from Boston. My grandparents said that they would like me to come over for dinner, and I don't know how that's going to go, and I don't know how any of that's going to be, but just the fact that I was invited and the fact that they know that I'm going to be there and they're still coming down is a big step for all of us. You know, I have amazing people in my life today. That person that got me pregnant, his whole family has welcomed me with open arms. My dad was recently diagnosed with cancer, and my grandparents weren't happy about that because they felt like he's the only parent that I really have in my life now. We've had a pretty strange relationship for many years now, because he was aware of everything that I was doing, and he was having me get the same thing I was getting for myself for him. But when I got arrested, he was the only person that came to visit me in jail. My grandparents were not able to face me in jail. My dad was the only one that came. And he's there, and he's always been there for me. Even if, you know, he's not in the best situation himself, he's always been there for me. And he was recently diagnosed with cancer, and my grandparents freaked out about that. But my boyfriend's mom was like, you know, I'll go and talk to your grandparents and let them know that if anything happens to him, you do still have a parent because I'm here. And you have this whole family of people. And that's definitely a gift that I wouldn't have gotten any other, if I wasn't living the way I'm living today. I have amazing people in my life and so many things to be grateful for, and I could sit in bed all day and feel sorry for myself, and there are some days that I do, I'm not going to lie. There are some days when I just want to lay in bed and cry all day, and there are some days when I do it for a few hours, and there are some days when I wake up and I'm okay. I would love to tell you that I work this program perfectly. My ego would love to stand here and tell you that, you know, I pray every morning and every night, and I meditate for an hour, and I do an inventory every night, and those things just aren't true. You know, I pray a lot. I meditate probably 5 times a week. I do an inventory sometimes. It's just the reality. I'm not perfect at this, but, you know, all those things that I see as flaws and all those things that I'm afraid of are all things for me to learn and grow from. And I can face whatever comes my way today. And, you know, I'm still fearful sometimes, but I'm able to recognize that it's fear and not make those fear-based decisions and show up for things and be present. And that's definitely one of the biggest things, because when I was out there, I was never present. I was anywhere but where I was sitting right next to you. But I'm able to be present for all these amazing things. I went to church on Sunday, and I was sitting in between my grandparents. And I got there a little bit late, and my grandfather had, like, taken the little bulletin and set it up in his hymnal so that he knew exactly where to turn to. And he picked it up and just was like, sorry, I need this one. You can follow along, though. And that's something that I just really appreciated. Like, it was just a moment that I really wouldn't have paid attention to or would have found annoying that he was trying to switch things. And I was just there for it. And I know that sounds totally crazy and just very random, but it was a pretty random moment, but but it was, you know, it was significant to me. So thank you so much for having me here tonight, and thanks for letting me share.